2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 7. This is Paul, and he's speaking of some experiences that he's had, some visions that he's had. And in verse 7, we find ourselves in a familiar part of this book. It says, "And lest I should be exalted above measure, through the abundance of the revelations, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure. For this thing I besought the Lord thrice, that it might depart from me. And he said unto me, My grace is sufficient for thee, my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities and reproaches and necessities and persecutions and distresses for Christ's sake. For when I'm weak, then I'm strong." And I want to stop there. The title of the message this morning is just simply going to be, My Grace is Sufficient. And if there was a little subtitle, it would be Real Grace for Real Life. This is a familiar verse for us. It's one that's really often quoted. And if I could be honest with you, most of the times maybe me, I hear this verse quoted or I think about this verse, void of what it, you know, the true meaning that's there. For whatever reason, we have a tendency whenever we think about grace, and when I say this, I don't want to make it, I'm not downplaying grace, because it's obvious and crystal clear that every single spiritual blessing that we have comes through grace. It's by the grace of God that we are what we are, that we have what we have, that we are in fellowship with Him, and that we're not hopeless and condemned to hell for an eternity. That's the grace of God. But when we're talking about grace, and it's the same kind of thing, when we're talking about grace here, and when Paul says, "My grace is sufficient," when God says, "My grace is sufficient for you in your weakness," I'm afraid a lot of times we think about that as that God's grace is somehow going to make hard situations easy, or make you happy in sad, difficult times of loss, or make you numb when you ought to be feeling a whole lot of hurt. And so I guess what I mean by that is, a lot of times, maybe not you, maybe it's just me, but we kind of look at that and we hear that in ways that we kind of interpret in our own minds that God's grace is just kind of a numbing medicine for us, so that we really don't have to go through real life at all. It's just kind of a plane ticket out. And so we bypass all the hard stuff and we land on the other side totally unaffected, and we can say, "Thank God for His grace." Now, anybody that's lived, I don't know, more than a couple of days, if you can express your own experience, knows that that's just not the case. Even though it's the way it's understood a lot of times, that's the way I look at it a lot of the times. And so when I say real grace for real life, I want to look at this in a real way, because while grace is necessary, while grace is amazing, while grace is we can't function without it, one thing that grace is not, grace is not an escape from real life. It's just not. Grace is not an escape from pain. Grace is not an escape from sorrow. It's not an escape from difficult situations. And so I want to look, I want to spend the first part of our time in Exodus, and then I'd like to look at four things about grace. And I don't know that we'll get to them all this morning. But the first thing I want to just kind of give you a little bulleted outline of where we're going. The first thing I want to look at after we get finished with Exodus is the fact that whenever you suffer, God is near. And that's grace. Did you get that? When you suffer. Not when you ought to be suffering and you don't, but when you suffer, God is near. Second thing is grace does not make trials or afflictions easy or pleasant. Grace just makes them doable. Grace makes them doable. It's not a romantic view here of making it more than what it really is. There's real tears that are shed whenever people are surrounded with grace. There are real pains that are felt. There are real hurts that are experienced. And grace makes that doable. Third thing, grace teaches us that if we're God's, God's not mad at us. God's not mad at us. Listen, even when you sin, God's not mad at you. That's not the same thing as saying sin is no big deal and God doesn't care anything about it. That's not the same thing. The reason God's not mad at you, even when you sin, if you belong to Him, is because through grace, all the anger that ought to be taken out on you, all the wrath that should have been pouring out on us, all the hell that we should have experienced was put on Jesus Christ. And so grace teaches us that even when we sin, I say even, when we sin, if we belong to Him, God is not mad at us. He's not keeping tabs on us. He's not waiting until He can finally lay down the hammer one final time. That's not it. And then the last thing, and obviously grace teaches us more than this, but the fourth thing, grace teaches us that we're children dependent on and learning from our Father. That's what grace teaches us, that we are children that are dependent on and we are learning from our Father. Again, whenever we get to this area, even though we know it and even though we've heard it, we all tend to run to the place to where we feel like if we're growing in grace, we ought to be able to get to the point to where we're growing a little more independent than we used to be. And we're not, it's not as necessary for us to cling to the things that we normally cling to for help. We think that if we're going to grow in grace, that means we're able to get ourselves better and we're able to do things right and we're not making as many mistakes. And even though whenever you do grow in maturity, there is a sense in which you do become more holy in the sense of you're able to overcome sin. But there's also a sense that there's always going to be a besetting sin. There's always going to be more than we would even want to admit and probably more than we ever even notice. Sins that we fall into and fall short on. And so we have to understand one thing that grace teaches us is that the point of salvation right now is not that we're wrapped up in perfect little boxes with perfect little bows and we can present ourselves before God by ourselves as being able to take the ball and run with it and become perfect on our own. That's not it. But the purpose right now of salvation is that we are growing as children dependent on a Father as sinners. So that whenever we are sinless with Him, our fellowship with Him is what we're working on now. The picture really that's here is a child growing with their parents, and any parent out there, and really anybody out there that's been around children very much understands that whenever you're working with a small child, you don't expect them to get it all right all at once, or really even ever, right? I've been working on thumbs up with Lily, and I'll say, Lily, thumbs up. And she'll look at me and she'll say, thumbs up, Daddy, thumbs up. And that's her thumbs up. And it's completely wrong. That's not even her thumb. But you know what? I love it. I do. I love it. One of these days she'll get the thumbs up, and that'll be that. But I love it. It's great. It doesn't bother me that she doesn't get it right. And listen, I'm a sinful person. I'm not trying to equate thumbs up with this, but I'm also not trying to make it too distant either, because if I'm that affectionate toward Lily and I'm those kinds of emotions and feelings and all that towards somebody that I love, somebody that's my child, how much more God toward His children? How much more God toward His children? And so the point is not that we present ourselves perfect to God. The point is God loves us and God is forming us, changing us into what He wants us to be. And our job is to maintain that relationship with Him and grow in grace. And the part where we begin to become less and less sinful is whenever we become more and more in love with and influenced by God and His love that He sheds out toward us. Not when we become so impressed with how self-righteous we are and our ability to cut off sins through our own power. That completely misses the point and sends us straight to hell. That's not it. And so those four things. I would like to start out in Exodus. And this in Exodus chapter 1. I'd like to take some points out of this and put what we're going to be talking about maybe into a context, at least the first part of it, of a story. I think it works. I think it works good that way, and I think that's why it's here for our learning. Exodus chapter 1. The story of Exodus is a story that is repeated probably more than any other story in the entire Bible, as far as God delivering His people from Egypt. It would come up again and again and again and again. In the prophets, God would tell His people to look back, think back of when He delivered them from Pharaoh, when He delivered them from Egypt. And that story, and it was a remarkable story, and it was really the first time that God worked in the lives of His nation as a people to deliver them. And so there are a lot of things here in this story. Just starting in chapter 1, I'm going to read the first 7 verses starting out, and then we're going to make our way down and get a few principles and just set the scene, what's going on here. Exodus chapter 1, verse 1. These are the names of the children of Israel, which came into Egypt. Every man in his household came with Jacob. Reuben, Simon, Levi, and Judah. Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher, and all the souls that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls, for Joseph was in Egypt already. And Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all that generation. And the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, and multiplied and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. And I want to stop there for a minute, because as we get into this first part of the story of Exodus, it's really the first 7 verses. And as you go back and hit the last several verses, chapters in Genesis, it's really a successful story for the children of Israel. Joseph, through the providence of God, obviously this part's not one that they really want to brag on too much, but they sold their brother into slavery, the Jacob's sons. He goes and eventually makes his way up into second command in the land of Egypt. A famine comes. It's revealed to Joseph that it's going to come. And so Joseph, really, God uses Joseph, and it's God that's doing the work, but He uses Joseph almost to single-handedly deliver the nation from destruction and famine. Joseph's brothers come. Through the working out of all that, they find out that that's Joseph. He brings his family there. His dad comes, and God's people settle there in Egypt. While they were in Egypt, of course, we read here in verse 7, they became a great people, great number. And that's a direct fulfillment of Genesis chapter 15, verses 1 through 5. God promised Abraham, you're going to have a people that's, they're going to be as many as the sands of the shore. They're going to be as many as the stars in the heavens. And that promise is coming to fruition here. They are growing and growing and growing and growing. Even in these verses here, the beginning here, as you recall the story, God had sent his people to Egypt. Jacob had gone there. Joseph had gone there ahead of time to save his nation. But also, God's people, God's nation had also saved the people in Egypt there from famine. And the people knew that. And up until we get to verse 8, the people there understood that God had blessed them. Do you remember what Pharaoh said about Joseph? There's not a man in Egypt who's filled with the spirit of wisdom, the spirit of God, like this man is right here. Even though Pharaoh was a pagan, we don't have any reason really to believe that Pharaoh had any kind of spiritual anything in him. But he recognized that, and the people recognized that, and they were grateful. And there's no doubt that as the generations came by, we know that, as the generations went on, that the story of Joseph and the character of Joseph was remembered, and the people of Israel were remembered, and they were treated well. But then we get to verse 8. We're going to go from verse 8 to verse 14. It says, "Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. And he said unto his people, Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. Therefore they did set them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were grieved because of the children of Israel. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and in brick and in all manner of service in the field. All their service wherein they made them serve was with rigor." And so after, really where we come in the scene here, is after Israel had enjoyed a pretty good time there in Egypt, a peaceful time, and there's a king that is raised up, Pharaoh's raised up there, and it says he didn't know Joseph. There rose up a new king over Egypt which knew not Joseph. Now that doesn't mean that he didn't know who Joseph was, or that he had no idea about the story and how all that went. The little phrase there, the fact that he didn't know Joseph, means that he just refused to recognize what Joseph had done for the people there in the past. He refused to give any credit to, or I guess any blessing for anything that had happened in the past. And he decided at that point that he was going to change the way that he dealt with Israel for one reason. Greed and pride. I guess you could put those as one. Greed and pride. They're multiplying, and he looks and he says, good grief, these people are getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And so through propaganda and through going and influencing the people in Egypt, he says, look, this is exactly what's going to happen. They're going to get so big, we're going to go to war with somebody, they're going to join there, they're going to come back and fight us, and they're going to destroy us because we're just sitting ducks. Let's deal wisely with these guys, and let's put them under bondage. And so here's what happened almost overnight. These Israelites, who were used to just a normal life, all of a sudden became slaves because somebody was jealous. And they became brick makers. I don't know if you've ever seen that done before. I worked one summer with Joseph at Old Mississippi Brick and Heart Pine, and they were doing those handmade bricks, and I know for a fact the conditions out there had to be way better than what they were talking about. But at the end of the day, these guys that were just—they were getting this—the mixture that they would mix for the brick, and they had these molds that would go through, and just all day long they were just kind of scooping it and throwing it down in there, scooping it and throwing it, scooping it and throwing it, rake it off, run it through all day long, all day long. And when they got out of there, you couldn't tell what nationality anybody was because they were all covered in all this dust and mud, and it was just head to toe nasty. And nobody had a smile on their face. I mean, it was hard work. Hard work. This is kind of a side note, but when Brother Joseph went to work there, one of the reasons he went was because he was, and still is, pretty blessed in the ability to manage folks. And so when he first got there, I was there pretty early on with him, and they were making, I don't know, whatever the production was. And he started noticing some things could change here, change here, change here. And so eventually he just said, we've got to up production on this, because they could. He wouldn't be unreasonable. And so he upped production pretty big. And man, they were furious. They were already worn out. They were already nasty. It was already a disgusting job. It was already a hard job. And whenever you went in and you asked them, look, we got to up production. Now these guys are getting paid and they're there on their own dime. I mean, they're getting paid for it. And they were furious. And you know what? I wouldn't want to do it either. Miserable job. It says these guys were forced to do it as slaves. They didn't have a choice. A lot of times we read through this and we forget all about the whole idea, or we don't even put into context the idea that they were literal slaves. They didn't have a choice in the matter. From now on, if you're an Israelite, you do what we tell you to do, when we tell you to do it, how we tell you to do it, and we don't want any back talk, because if you do, you're dispensable. We can get rid of you real quick, and there's so many of you, we can grab another one and throw him in line, and he can keep the work going, and it's not that big a deal. And that's exactly what was happening. And so they were doing this hard labor, they were making these brick, they were working out in the fields. Matter of fact, a couple of comments on this as I was reading was this. One scholar said this, that Israel was, at this point, organized in large work gangs. They became an anonymous mass. They were depersonalized. They were losing all their individuality in the eyes of their oppressors. They were just things. We see that happen, you know, nowadays. You look at events that we've seen really in our lifetime. I say in our lifetime, in the last 100 years, not my lifetime. You look at what happened in Rwanda when all those people were just wiped out. In Africa, all those people were just wiped out. You know why? Because the ones that were wiping them out, they said they were cockroaches. They weren't even human. They were just pests. They got on their nerves. So they just went through and killed them. Whenever Hitler was doing what he was doing, he was looking for the superior race. And whenever it came to the Jews and those who were Polish and that sort of thing, they weren't even real people to him. Kind of like we talk about the Samaritans being half-breeds. They weren't really even fully human. And so he could just go through and wipe them all out, because what they were doing was keeping his idea of the ultimate race was from being accomplished. And so that's what happened here. You know, these Israelites, they weren't even really on par, on level with where they were. They were just being mistreated because they were just things. Didn't really count as abuse. And then the last thing I have here on that is this. One guy said that conditions were somewhat as follows. A field worker's harvest is half eaten by worms, half eaten by a hippopotamus, and then thieves steal whatever's left. And then here's what an Egyptian writer says in reference to this. An Egyptian writer back from those days writing on this sort of thing says, The Egyptians say, this is the people of Israel, give us corn, but there is no corn. Then they beat him as he lies stretched out, bound on the ground. They throw him into a canal and he sinks down, head underwater. His wife is bound before his eyes and his children are put in fetters. And that's that. They come looking for corn and there's not any corn to get. And the reason there's no corn to get is because worms have eaten half of it, hippopotamus has eaten another half of it, and the thieves came in and stole the rest. And when the Egyptians show up and want to know where the corn is, and it's not there, and the Israelite can't help it's not there, they kill him and they bind his wife and they take his kids and they ship him off. Now, I don't know about you, but when I start reading this kind of stuff, it kind of adds a little bit to what the suffering was that the people of Egypt were experiencing then. It's not just a story, it's real life. It was real suffering. Not only that, but these were people that had gotten the promise, look where we are so far. We've got this much to go in the Bible. This much. While they know how God works in some way, there was not a whole lot revealed to them as far as what we have now. We're just talking about a few pages. And the suffering continues to go on and on and on and on. Gets to the point where Pharaoh gets these midwives and tells them when there's a male, you go ahead and kill him. When there's a female, you can let that female live. They don't do that, and so Pharaoh passes a law. Any Hebrew boy that's born, you kill him. You throw him in the river. And so if we were living back then, in that world at that time, as an Israelite, those who were alive when they were brought into slavery must have been wondering, what in the world's going on? You go from a life of peace and a life of what seemed to be really your salvation from the famine to a life of bitter, harsh, destructive treatment while you see all your family and all your people being disposed of as if they were really less than bugs. Worse than that, if you were born into that sort of thing, can you imagine that being your life? All you've ever known? All that you will ever know? Somebody had to ask the question, where in the world is God? Right? If we're honest with ourselves, we've been to the same place. Somebody, somewhere in the middle of all that, and I imagine it was more than one, had to ask the question, where in the world is God? We've multiplied, we're all this, and He made these big promises to Abraham, but now we're in the middle of these people that really are people saved, and all they're doing is killing us and wiping us out. And even though we're multiplied, it doesn't do any good, because day in and day out, we're either making brick or we're in the field, and whenever something happens that's really beyond anything that we can control, we're killed for it, and we're thrown away. And as far as we can tell, if this goes on much longer, all the males are being wiped out, and the nation of Israel will be no longer, and that's going to be that. Where's God? And then we get to chapter 3. We get to chapter 3. Now we're jumping around. By the way, before we get to chapter 3 and we read what's said here, just think about in your own life, in your own experiences. It may not have been that way. You may not have probably didn't outwardly think or say to yourself, "Where's God?" Because a lot of times we're a little too sound to ask that question. But think about times where you've just been desperate, not really for any other reason, but things are just not working out like they were supposed to. You know, I think we've sang the same song for the last, 10, 15 services, at Experience, whatever the number is there. I love that song. And I think a lot of you do too, because I've only called it out twice out of the 15 or how many ever times we've sang it. And I think one of the attractions of that is just how honest it is. I trusted in my own works. And He didn't say that in some general way. I was going to obey. I was going to do what I needed to do. I was going to keep going. I was going to gain favor that way. I was going to do everything I needed to do to get the blessings that I needed to earn, and I was going to obey. Until He figured out He couldn't. He just couldn't do it. And do you know what He ascribes that to? The grace of God. The grace of God. Do you know what's going on with the Israelites as they're being really placed into a fiery furnace here in the beginning of Exodus? You know what they're experiencing? They're getting ready to experience the grace of God, is what they're getting ready to experience. What they're experiencing right now is just the reality of a fallen world. We're not exempt. I'm not exempt. And you're not either. Even those who are God's people, are not exempt from what we talked about earlier. Pain, suffering, hurt, unfair treatment. Things you just want to throw your hands up and walk away and just give up. We're not exempt from that. We never have been and we never will be. And I think really one of the reasons why there's so much, it's so difficult to be content sometimes is because for some reason we've believed the lie that we're supposed to be immune from all this stuff. It's just not true. It's just not true. Grace doesn't keep you from hurting. Grace doesn't keep you from suffering. Grace doesn't keep you from being treated unfairly. It doesn't do any of that. And if that's the idea you have, you're thinking about something else because it's not grace. You're thinking about fairy dust, and that doesn't exist. And that's just the truth of it. And so what about it? What about, you know, after you had an experience with the Lord and you really felt like God had done a work in you? But things just didn't line up the way you thought they were. You still had struggles. You still had things that plague you. By the way, if that's your case, join the club. Some people lie about it, but everybody struggles with it. We've all got things that we're having a hard time with. And so what about that? How does that line up with Scripture? How does it line up with what we thought was going to happen? Where's God in all that? Why in the world is He not doing this whole sanctification deal a lot faster than He is? Wouldn't it be easier on Him and us? Seems like it would. And as I say that, I hope you know I'm saying that in a sarcastic way. I wouldn't try to stand up here and tell God He ought to be doing something He's not. But here's where God is. In Exodus chapter 3, as Moses is out and he's tending the flock, he comes upon the fiery, the burning bush. And then in verse 7, this is where we start here. And the Lord said, this is what He says to Moses, "I have surely seen the affliction of My people which are in Egypt. And I have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters. For I know their sorrows, and I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land unto a good land and large land, flowing with milk and honey, unto places in the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel is come unto Me, and I have also seen the oppression wherewith the Egyptians oppressed them. Now come therefore, and I will send thee to Pharaoh, that thou mayest bring forth My people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." You want to know where God was during all that? Well, the answer, the obvious answer is He was in heaven doing what He pleased, doing what He wanted to do. And while I wouldn't try to take that answer and turn it into anything but truth, because it is truth, there's more to it than that. Because God was in heaven doing what He wanted to do, but you know what He was doing? He was raising up a man that was going to deliver those people out of the bondage that they were in. He was putting the people who would later find out once they hit the wilderness how ungrateful they really were and how all their problems weren't because of the taskmasters and the Egyptians that just ruled over them with such a hard thumb, even though they experienced all kinds of suffering back there. He was raising up a people that were going to realize really soon that their biggest problem was the sin that they struggled with and how ungrateful they were themselves for what God had done for them. And even though all that's true, you know what God says first? "I've seen the affliction of My people. I've heard their cry." I know about a year ago we went through a message called "Our Compassionate God." We looked at God's compassion, and I'm going to hit some of that stuff again because I want you to know that really what's going on in the workings here in Exodus chapter 1 is that God's really bringing the reality of what these people are to light. He's bringing their sinfulness really to light because outside of the backdrop of all that oppression, you know, If you really want to see what a man, if you really want to see a man's true character, go talk to him when he's agitated. Go talk to him when he's upset, when he feels like he's been treated unfairly. It's really easy to play the humble card whenever everything's going just right. You know, it's really easy to be content when we have no reason to be discontent. But talk to somebody whenever they're in the middle of a trial, whenever they're in the middle of suffering. And whatever's there is going to come out. What's God doing? He's showing these people who they really are. And He's doing it in a compassionate way. It doesn't seem very compassionate, but God is being compassionate as He does this. He's going to deliver them. He's seen their affliction. He's heard their cry. He knows what's going on. And then it says this, "And I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians." God says, "I've come down to deliver them. And I'm sending you to go do it, Moses. But don't forget the fact that it's me that's delivering the people of Egypt. I'm going to let you have a part in it, but I'm doing that. And the reason I'm doing that is because I've seen their affliction. I've heard their cry. I've seen that how harsh these taskmasters are with them. And I'm delivering them out of this." And so as the story goes, the long, long, must have felt like forever to Moses, process before these Pharaoh finally allows the people to go. And then when he does, the people end up spending 40 years wandering around in the wilderness. And you know what you can attribute every bit of that to? Grace. Every bit of it. Grace. That's not the picture we think about when we think about grace. Right? Children of Israel are supposed to get out of Egypt quick and go hit the water park. And everybody's supposed to be laughing and having a good time and having a party. And then they're going to go to a land where they don't even have to do anything but go dip their cups in the river that's full of milk and there's honey all over the place. And you literally take all this stuff, you know, how it is, and you think, well, isn't that the way it's supposed to be? Isn't God supposed to take Israel from that harsh bondage that they were in all those years and send them to a Disney World to allow some emotional healing to go on? No. That's not real life. That's not real life. And as it's exaggerated and we smile at that, we've all been there where we thought, good grief, I just need a break from all this. It may not be Disney World, but it's somewhere. And it's just not real life. It's just not. Two things I want to get out of Exodus before we move on. Number one, when it looked like God was absent, He wasn't. When it looked like God was absent and distant, He was not. And then the second thing is that when it looked like Pharaoh was in full control of the fate of the people of Israel, He wasn't. He wasn't. He thought He was. They even thought He was. But He wasn't. He was not. And so for what time we have left, I want to stay for now in Exodus. And I want to hit our first bullet, really, on this, the whole idea of real grace for real life. We're not talking about a pie in the sky deal where we just kind of ignore everything and go numb. We're talking about the strength that God gives you, the ability that God gives you to go through painful situations and come out on the other side. Exodus 3, 7 through 10 is what we just read, and that's the first one. God said He had seen their affliction of His people. He had heard their cry, and He came down to deliver them. He was going to do something about it. He didn't just stand up there with His hands crossed. In Exodus 22, 23, God, let's go there. Remember the topping, the little heading here. When you suffer, God is near. God hears. God's not unaware. In Exodus 22:23, it starts out. Let me back up. Let me go to 22. Exodus 22:22 says, "You shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child If thou afflict them in any wise, and they cry at all unto me, I will surely hear their cry." Now, why do I say that? I just say that because God is interested in Moses and the rest of Israel understanding this principle about God. When you afflict, and look who he's talking about. He's talking about people who are naturally going to suffer. When you afflict the fatherless, or when you afflict the widow, people who are naturally vulnerable, I guess, and they even cry unto me a little bit, you can be sure of this, I will hear them when they cry. I will hear them when they cry. You in a vulnerable situation? Are you in a spot that's tight and you really wish it wasn't there? God hears you when you cry. God hears you when you cry. These guys over in Exodus waited 430 years. 430 years. But God hears you when you cry. Judges chapter 10. Judges chapter 10, I'm going to start in verse 10, and I'm going through verse 16, so it's going to be several verses here. "And the children of Israel cried unto the Lord, saying, We have sinned against thee, both because we have forsaken our God, and also served Balaam. And the Lord said unto the children of Israel, Did not I deliver you from the Egyptians, and from the Amorites, and from the children of Ammon, and the Philistines, and the Zidonians, and the Malachites, and the Mananites, that oppressed you, and you cried to me, and I delivered you out of their hand? Yet you have forsaken me and served other gods, wherefore I deliver you no more. Go and cry to the gods that you have chosen. Let them deliver you in the time of your tribulation. And the children of Israel said unto the Lord, We have sinned. Do thou unto us whatsoever seemeth good unto thee. Deliver us only, we pray thee, this day. And they put away the strange gods from among them and served the Lord. And his soul was grieved for the misery of Israel." Little short synopsis of what's going on here. The children of Israel had rebelled against God like they will do again and again and again and again. And by the way, like we will do again and again and again and again. They come back and they say, Lord, forgive us. We've sinned against you. And God says, you know what? I've already forgiven you. Do you not remember whenever I delivered you out of the land of Egypt from the Ammonites? All these enemies of yours, I delivered you. I was faithful and you've gone and you've served other gods. Let those gods deliver you now. Go let them fix what you've messed up. Let them take my place. And then it says that they put those gods away from them. They began to serve God. And it says this about God. Don't forget this about the character of God. It says that when he saw their misery, his soul was grieved for Israel. That doesn't even make sense as far as we're talking about the character of God. The one who's self-sufficient, the one who's omnipresent, omnipotent, the one who's all in all, the one in whom we live and breathe and have our being, the one who says anything he wants to say and it comes to pass, the one who's so holy he can't even look on sin, and then it says about these people who were rebellious against him that all of a sudden come back and they repent, his soul was grieved for their misery. And he acted on their behalf, that he delivered them. But it wasn't because he was just up there saying, okay, you've whined enough and you're getting on my nerves, so here we go, let me give you what you're asking for. That wasn't it. His soul was grieved for their misery. He's a compassionate God. He's a compassionate God. In Isaiah 63, Isaiah 63, verse 7. I will mention the loving kindness of the Lord and the praises of the Lord according to all that the Lord hath bestowed on us, and the great goodness toward the house of Israel, which he hath bestowed on them according to his mercies and according to the multitude of his loving kindness. For he said, Surely they are my people, children that will not lie, so He was their Savior. In all their affliction, He was afflicted, and the angel of His presence saved them. In His love and in His pity, He redeemed them, and He bare them, and He carried them all the days of old. He says, I'm going to recount right now the loving kindness of the Lord. I'm going to mention these things, the loving kindness of the Lord. And he goes through and he's naming some things off. And then he says, he gets to the point and he says that these are my people. They're the children. I'm their Savior. And in all their afflictions, I was afflicted. Where was God in the midst of the afflictions there of Israel? I don't know how all this works. I think the New Testament teaching of this would be the fact that Christ is touched with the feelings of our infirmities. When His people were in affliction, He was afflicted. He was grieved for the misery of His people. You see, it might even be a little easier for us to understand if it just said He was just kind of unmoved and let His people go through what they brought on themselves anyway. I mean, that kind of sounds harsh, but anybody, in all honesty, that had ever dealt or ever had to deal with somebody that was as rebellious as what it describes here couldn't really blame somebody that would finally throw their hands up and say, good grief, you've made your bed and I lay in it, there it is. This is what you wanted all this time, go ahead. But that's not the picture. The picture is that in all their afflictions, He was afflicted. He was touched with the feelings of their infirmities. He was grieved at their misery. And so when you suffer, God is near. He's not a distant God. He's not a distant God. When you suffer, God is near. A few more minutes here. I'm going to go to the second one. Grace does not make trials or afflictions easy or pleasant. It just makes them doable. It does not make trials and afflictions easy or pleasant. It makes them doable. Grace allows you to look your circumstances straight in the eyes and go. Grace allows you to not look for some quick fix or some easy way to get around it and not actually face what it is that's going on. Really, if we could just plainly lay it out, grace allows you to be you. Not in the sense of you just stay the way you are, that's not any big deal, but in the sense of the reality is you're a sinner, you're a rebel, you bring a whole lot of stuff on yourself, but there's a way out. And grace lets you recognize every bit of that without trying to sugarcoat it, without trying to sugarcoat yourself, without trying to sugarcoat everybody else's actions, but just being plain and honest. I'm a sinner. I've brought this on myself. Or either, I've been mistreated. I've been the recipient of harsh treatment from other sinners. Either of the two. But God's grace will let me get through this. God's grace will let me get through it. So, it doesn't make it easy, it doesn't make it pleasant, it makes it doable. Philippians 4:13. Philippians 4:13. I can do all things through Christ which strengthens me. I can do all things through Christ which strengthens me. Here Paul's talking about contentment here. He's learned to be content whenever he's had a lot, whenever he's had a little, and then he just goes on and says this, I can do all things through Christ which strengthens me. Through the strength of Christ, I can do all things. Now notice he could have said a whole lot more about this, but he does not. He doesn't say it makes it jolly. Whenever James says that you ought to count it a blessing, count it all joy, when you face diverse temptations, and he's not talking about you giggling your way through a painful experience, but he says joy because you know this is what it's producing in your life. Here's the fruit that's going to be produced because of the hardship that you're going through right now. It's Philippians 4:13. This is a verse that's pretty common. If you go watch any marathoners run, you'll see that on the back of a lot of people's shirts. Philippians 4:13, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, which is fine, whatever. I mean, that's. But you know what? Those people that cross the finish line that just have a plain white T-shirt are huffing and puffing, and it looks like they're about a split second away from death. You know what the people look like that have the Philippians 4:13 on the back of their shirt? The same as the people with the white shirt. They're huffing and puffing, about ready to die when they cross that finish line. It didn't make it any easier for them. They still had to run the same race. They're still tired. They still probably... I don't know. We've got runners in here that know exactly what I'm talking about. You know, I mean, still got to get water, still got to get Gatorade, still got to eat those nasty jelly beans for those electrolytes that you need to get, all that stuff. You do get through it, but not with a smile, and not in any better shape than the person beside you. You get through it. 2 Corinthians 12. Where we started. Paul says, "Lest I should be exalted above measure through the abundance of the revelations, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure. For this thing I besought the Lord thrice, that it might depart from me. And he said unto me, My grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, persecutions, and distresses, for Christ's sake. For when I'm weak, then I'm strong." Now, whenever we get to the end of this section here, especially around 9 and 10, we're not careful, we get the idea that all of a sudden Paul looks forward to all these bad things happening to him. "I besought the Lord three times, and God says, My grace is sufficient for you. My strength is made perfect in your weakness." And then Paul says, "Most gladly will I rather glory in my infirmities than the power, that the power of Christ may rest upon me." Now, when Paul gets finished with that and he goes on to talk about the rest of it, Paul was not a Superman. He was not unaffected by persecutions. He was not unaffected by the other things he's talking about, infirmities and reproaches and this distress. He's not unaffected by any of that. But he does say, "Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities." But the thought really that Paul's conveying there, and I don't want to explain it away, but I don't want to make it something it's not either. The thought that Paul's conveying there is the same thought that James is talking about when he says you ought to count it all joy when you go through diverse temptations. It wasn't as if Paul was sitting around waiting for the next trial to come around because it just, you know, he just loved it. It wasn't that it was an enjoyable experience, but he said, "You know what I've found out? That when I'm weak, that's really when I'm strong. And my infirmities, that's really where Christ shows up more. Where I know I can't perform, where I know I'm helpless, that's where Christ shows up. That's where He shows up." And so He says, "I'll go through it. It's worth it. I can see the end product." But He doesn't enjoy it in the sense of getting any kind of pleasure out of weakness or infirmity. Nobody does. Two more verses and then we're done for this morning. I have a note here, another thing, and I've said it in other words, but as far as Paul and what he says here, the fact is that he will willingly endure pain because he knows that that pain is forcing him to draw closer to God. He will willingly endure that pain because he knows it's forcing him to draw closer to God. And that's the way it is in all of our lives. I've heard several people get up and say that in this church. You get into a hard spot, you get into a spot where it just hurts and it's painful and it's uncomfortable. And you wake up and realize you really do need God. And you realize you're not half as big as you thought you were. And you really don't have it together. And you really can't fake your way through. And this whole idea about us being sinners really is true. And it's not just a fairy tale that we say so we can get into a church and have good fellowship with folks. And that unless we're sinners, it doesn't matter anyway because God came to save sinners. And so we're just fooling ourselves if we're trying to come be anything else. Paul says, you know, I'm going to endure this because it's good for me. It doesn't feel good, but it's good for me. It forces me to draw closer to God. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, moving back a little bit. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Corinthians 4:8, Paul says, we're troubled on every side, yet we're not distressed. We're perplexed, but not in despair. We're persecuted, but we're not forsaken. We're cast down, but we're not destroyed. Always bearing about the body, the dying of the Lord Jesus, that the life also of Jesus might be made manifest in our bodies. Now, again, Paul's not painting a picture here that is one of enjoyable picture. We're troubled on every side, but we're not distressed. We're perplexed, but we're not in despair. We're persecuted, but we're not forsaken. We're cast down, but we're not destroyed. In other words, God's grace has helped us get through every bit of that. He's not signing up for a second round, but he said while he was going through it, the grace of God allowed him to do that. And then the last one here, in 2 Corinthians chapter 7. Verse 5. It says, for when we were come into Macedonia, our flesh had no rest, but we were troubled on every side. Without were fightings, within were fears. Nevertheless, God that comforteth those that are cast down comforted us by the coming of Titus. He says, when we got to Macedonia, it was a mess. There were fightings. There were fears. It was not, I don't know if it's what they were expecting or not, but he's not painting a good picture. And then he says, nevertheless, and this is why I put this down, because this is not a verse where Paul says, this is what happened, even though he says that. He talks about God and characterizes God in a certain way. He says, even though we got there and there were all these fightings and there were all these fears, nevertheless, God, comma, here's the description, here's where he's going to make a characterized remark about God. God, comma, that comforteth those that are cast down, comma, comforted us by the coming of Titus. He could have just said, God comforted us by the coming of Titus, but that's not what he said. He said, God, by the way, you ought to know this already, he's the one that comforts those who are cast down, comforted us also. He was true to his character. He comforted us too. And you know how he did it? He did it with Titus. And so I want you to know that God's characterized by being a God who comforts those who are cast down. That's just who He is. That's what He's known for. Now when we come back this afternoon, we're going to look at the fact that grace teaches us that God's not mad at us. And then grace teaches us that we're children that are dependent on and we are learning from our Father. And so again, His grace is sufficient. But you've got to have the right idea of grace. And we're talking about real grace for real life. Real grace in a fallen world. Real grace for real hurts. Let's pray.